Okay, so last time we spent the hour and a half talking about classification methods and their use in and their use of genomic technologies in close to direct, which we called indirect applications to clinical medicine. And we talked about three different types of class methods, again, class exploration, class prediction, and class discovery. And I think we sort of finished with a discussion about class prediction, which is a basic approach that's used to, that starts with microarray data from a certain number of patients, builds a certain model, and then tries to predict something. Everybody who was here kind of remember that, vaguely at least. And the basic steps of class prediction were first to choose a gene set, so choose a number of genes that's representative of the data and that divides the data into classes for which you're targeting your predictions, to construct a function, a prediction function, that will be a mathematical function that you'll take a new sample with its expression data and plug into the function and get out an answer, and then determine a rule to try and then use the rule to classify one way or the other, and then lastly, validation. Okay, so I thought what we would do today is go through an example. Let's see, we went through all this. So I'm not sure we need this anymore. I thought what we would do today is go through an example, and the example is related to breast cancer and the paper from Nature 2002 that we talked about. I also, so the issue of New England Journal of Medicine that was published today had a number of articles related to use of these classification methods in AML, in acute myelogenous leukemia. Today's. Well, there's two different papers. There's an editorial and there's a perspective written. Maybe we'll look at the perspective for a second. And the perspective is called Microarrays and Clinical Investigations. And so the perspective is pretty bold in its views here, and essentially the last paragraph, the take-home message. So the take-home message is that our usual thinking about biomarker discovery in clinical trials is about to change dramatically. In the future, clinical investigations will consist of small trials with a high density of data, precise patient stratification according to the expression profile, and highly tailored analysis of microarray data. So they are looking at the articles in this issue of gene expression in AML and the focus on identifying sort of the relevant, so looking through 7,000 genes, or I think one study had used U133 arrays with 13,000, another with 25,000, looking at large number of genes and their expression in patients and identifying smaller numbers that are very relevant to disease. And that's what's meant by the term biomarkers here. And they're making a prediction that this is going to change the way clinical trials are being done dramatically. This seems very unlikely to me that this will...
Yeah, I was really curious because when reading the articles, at least glancingly, they seem very bread and butter.
Uh-huh.
Just classification and some prediction. And I was just curious as to how they do it. The New England Journal of Medicine is very reticent to take anything under 500 patients.
Uh-huh.
That's what struck me, really.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, it's a learning process for everybody. There are things to learn from the breast cancer work that was done, and we'll do go over the Nature paper, and that also was published in New England Journal of Medicine as well. Let me give you Let's see, I had this one for you, and this one is important. This one you have already.
Yes, I know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So let's I didn't have time to review the AML stuff that's accompanying the editorials and perspective in today's issue. I think it would be nice to go through that and look at the data directly and instead of the claims in the editorial, but let's do that for the breast cancer work that was done. So this is the paper. You might want to have it just so you have it here, because we're gonna, I thought rather than talking in the abstract as we did last time, to really go through concretely the use of the prediction method here, which is used quite similarly in one of these papers here. So let's go through this Nature paper on gene expression profiling predicting clinical outcome of breast cancer. So in this paper, essentially what these authors did in the abstract, you can see that they used microarray analysis on primary breast tumors of 117 young patients and applied supervised classification to identify a gene expression signature strongly predictive of a short interval to distant metastasis. So again, this is, again, I often get tripped up by viewing things in terms of the specific tool that was used, and really what they're doing is doing prediction here. So of our different pigeonholes that I try to put things in, class exploration, prediction, and discovery, this is prediction. Supervised classification is one aspect of it, but there are other parts of this too, to doing prediction. But what they were interested in essentially is taking patients and making good or bad predictions of prognosis, of outcome, based on their gene expression. So they did a variety of things, but most of this paper is focused, if we look at, say, the second paragraph on the first page after the abstract, an unsupervised hierarchical clustering algorithm allowed us to cluster the 98 tumors, so now we're down to 98 from 117, we'll come back to that, on the basis of their similarities measured over approximately 5,000 significant genes. And that's figure 1A. Okay. So here, and they have things sort of sideways. They have the specimens as the rows and the genes as the columns in that top diagram. And so this is this is hierarchical clustering of this data set that consists of a big table. And the table, again, has 98 patient samples and 5,000 genes. And expression levels, which that I might be short on the paper. Why don't you guys look on that for now? Yeah. Yeah. This paper is up on the site. Okay, so this is the data set that they constructed. Right?
I just have a question about some figure 1A in particular.
Okay.
What's the utility of something like this in the paper so they're obviously, they're not looking at this, like, if when they get their data and they see something like this, they feed it into a computer that does all this analysis. So what's the purpose of showing us this rather than just kind of cutting to the chase of what, like, their actual results are? I mean, should this be standard for, like, when, you know, if we're thinking about doing using potential studies or whatever?
I think they're pretty valuable diagrams because they do allow you, this is the black and white, so there's the color version. They do allow you to see that there are different patterns of expressions of genes in different subgroups.
I guess maybe these lower ones are blow-ups of particular regions where it may become more obvious.
Right.
But I'm thinking just in terms of, like if I saw an SDS page gel in a paper, it's just like, you know, right there you can see results. Or but if I look at something like this, it just looks like, you know, a bunch of pixels that are, you know, color or whatever.
You ask for motivation?
Well, yeah, I mean, so, the subfigures can be useful, I guess, or, and maybe I can see how you'd say, okay, this is the region we expanded on, or something.
But even in the big figures, you can often see, and maybe I have a picture of this on color that I can put up. I'm not sure if I do, but I should. But you can see that there are different groups, even within color. Sorry, I'm seeing patients.
And I guess sort of as a newbie here to looking at my, you know, these
guys. Yeah, well, that's,
you know, traditionally you see something like the, you know, when I'm seeing something like this, I just go, well, gee, that looked pretty, and I have no idea what it means, and, you know, or whatever. And I think that it can be kind of intimidating to people to when they pick up a paper like this who, you know, you see this and this, they don't quite get the point of seeing something like
that. Well, there's two issues, but that's an independent issue. I think there's an issue that I find compelling about these things. It's the same thing as looking at a scattergram. Why should you involve look at a scattergram rather than just give a correlation coefficient describing data? It's just giving me a sort of a look right test to see, do I actually see by visual inspection that it looks like there's class in there. And so when I look at this thing, I can actually convince myself that there's a lot of crap, but there is also some big chunks of red.
Yeah, so definitely the color picture
helps a lot.
Helps, yeah, helps.
The other part of these pictures which is helpful are the dendrograms. Okay, so again, we talked about the use of hierarchical clustering as a classification method in that it does not really produce classes. Okay, again, everything is related to everything else. We don't have disjoint classes. It's just that the degree of relationship is represented by the distance, literally the length of this this line right here in the diagram represents the relationship between these two over here and, say, these two over here. And so, again, everything, every cluster is split. This is binary. So everything is split into two. And so the adjacency is actually another issue, too, about these, is that you can spin any one of these clusters at any node without changing the organization here. So sometimes you will see diagrams. Why don't I show you one since we're planning on getting to nitty gritty here. Yeah.
When you have a paper and you see that figure, just apart from the obvious, like here's a really big red patch, let's go. That's what the proposal.
Right.
You're also, as someone who's familiar with this, you're also gathering other by seeing that. Without having data in hand, you can look at that figure and say, pattern, but here's another part of the figure that also gives me some more information. And me as the newbie, I'm just not seeing it because I'm not as familiar with that.
Oh, I don't have a password here. I can't do this. Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment. Okay. what I was going to show you is that there's been, in my area, last week there was a publication, it's the second one this group has done, where they put one of these diagrams up here, and they're showing that three patients with one condition, they all clustered together and separate from another seven. okay? But they don't put the diagram, they don't put the dendrogram on that. All they show is adjacency of rows, and they don't show exactly how they're organized or connected. So you see three that are here and then another seven that are here, but it's possible that this one over here is actually part of a group of four over here. And so that's another value to these diagrams, is when people claim classes to look and see. When you look at this one, you know, it's not overwhelming, actually. I mean, this is where they drew the line and they took this as one class. But this is really, I mean, every one of these is just sort of subdivided here instead of one fairly large class. So there is helpful information to seeing those diagrams.
So the leftmost is the two classes, the article 117.
That's correct. These are their two classes. So this is one branch here, and this is the other branch here. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's get into the nitty gritty, to at least so we have one example that we've understood fairly well what's happening. Okay. So this is an example. So this is just hierarchical clustering. What would you call this if I made you pigeonhole it into class exploration, class prediction, or class discovery? Okay, these are 98 patients with breast cancer. These are both lymph node positive and lymph node negative. They're pretty much all of their samples, except for a group that they've left off for other purposes. This would be an example of class exploration. So they're starting by looking at their data, and they're just saying, well, does it look like the expression profiles differ among patients and allow us to find different subgroups, different profiles? Okay. Now, we talked about one step that was important to do sort of before this, and that was the stuff about signatures and their reproducibility and their distinctness. They don't provide any data here in that regard. They say that they did every tumor sample twice, that they did two independent array profiles on each one, but they don't say anything about what they did with that data. They don't provide any correlation coefficients, for example, to say that when you do this same experiment twice on a given tissue, you get out the same pattern of genes. Okay, but accepting that, this first step is sort of exploration. And this, and here there is an attempt to correlate these groups with different clinical features. Okay, so first they do hierarchical clustering of the entire data set, and they sort of look and see broad patterns. Maybe there is a group over here that's more red for these genes and greens for these, and so maybe there is some structure here. So the next step they do is to, for each one of these patients, they look at binary outcomes and say, if this patient here had a mutation in the BRCA1 gene, they'll color it in black, and this patient here did not have a mutation. Okay, so for each one of these 98 patients, they're now looking at 6 different phenotypic markers, and coloring it in this way so that we can then sort of look and say, is there any relationship between these phenotypic variables and these two classes, which were defined by the dendrogram? Okay. Again, to pigeonhole it into one of the three class methods, what are they doing here? What's that? Class exploration, class discovery. They're doing class discovery here. So they looked at their data, they explored it, they wondered that there might be classes, and they're now asking, is there something significant phenotypically, that something meaningful clinically, that relates to these two classes? Or is it just an artifact of doing clustering, which will always reduce things into classes? Depending on where you cut this tree, you can have two classes here, or this one here, there looks like there's a large class which goes from here down to here. You can sort of make up classes at any different level here, because fundamentally there really are no classes with a dendrogram. But they're now saying, well, what phenotypic variables might correlate with this sort of split right here? This is still discovery. Yeah, I would call this class discovery, that they found two classes, and now that to establish them as truly classes that have some meaning, some clinical meaning, they want to say what clinical variables might this relate to. Here. And so looking at the things here, there are a few things which are fairly striking, I guess. The presence of estrogen receptors on the tumor cells here is pretty good. Most of these patients are ER positive. Most of these patients here are, actually, I can't remember which is black and which is white, which is positive and which is negative for their classes here. Metastases, so the presence of, and I think this is distance metastases at 5 years, not really too much difference. Maybe, I think white is present, so maybe more of these. What's that?
White is positive.
So there were maybe more consistently, certainly a larger percentage of this group had distant metastases at 5 years. Okay. So once they do this and believe that they do have classes here, they then move to the next step and say, we're going to build a predictive model. And this is the one that they focus on, is whether there's metastases or not. So they're saying in this data, there seems to be some way to classify the data that has some distinctions in terms of predicting outcome. And we're going to take it a step further here and actually go through the trouble of building a model to predict this. Okay? All right. So let's...
So they want to use metastases as the phenotypic predictor for this thing.
Uh-huh.
Why? Maybe this is just another ignorant question.
Like, no, there's no ignorant questions here.
Why did they choose that instead of, like, the estrogen receptor?
Well, yeah, because people already know about the estrogen receptor and BRCA1 mutations. And metastasis is the... It's fundamentally the important thing. It's the important clinical endpoint. If we can make better predictions based on gene expression profiles of tumor when we do an initial biopsy on the breast cancer, can we use that to then decide how to treat people? People who have a good prognosis don't need that same sort of treatment as people with a bad prognosis. Maybe. I mean, it doesn't actually, there's no treatment intervention, it's not a treatment study here. It's not saying that we can intervene and alter prognosis through treatment. It's strictly predictive of prognosis at this point. Okay. Okay, so let's go back to the paper. And so the next thing they do after this sort of class exploration, this sort of partial class discovery. I mean, they don't sort of carry it further and say that we really have discovered a new class here, because they really haven't. I mean, what the prognosis is really correlating with is the estrogen receptor status here, which is a well-known fact. So patients who are estrogen receptor positive have a better outcome, I think, in breast cancer. So I'm not sure about the black being positive or negative. The black is negative. Okay. Yeah, that's right. So patients who are estrogen receptor positive have a better outcome. The estrogen receptor negative patients, by and large, have a bad outcome. Yeah. So there's actually nothing new. There's no sort of important class discovery that took place in this paper. So what they next do is change the data set, little bit. Let's shut this off. Let's shut it down. Yep. So the next step that they do in this paper, and that's on this page 532. Oh, no, bottom of the first page. Sorry, bottom of page 530. Is they focus now on a subgroup of these samples on the 78 patients with sporadic lymph node negative disease. So these are all patients who, at the time of the diagnosis of their breast cancer, had lymph node biopsies which were negative and did not show any spread to the lymph nodes. And so they then focus the rest of the paper on this select group of patients, lymph node negative, and also sporadic, which means none of these had mutation, the BRCA1 or even BRCA2 mutations. They were not genetic breast cancers, patients with genetic. And so in that 78 group, 44 patients were free of disease after 5 years, and 34 patients developed metastasis. So we're down to 78 patients, and 44 had good prognosis, or turned out to have a good outcome, and 34 had poor outcome. Okay. So what they then say on the next page, 532, is to identify reliably good and poor prognostic tumors, we used a powerful three-step supervised classification method, similar to those used previously. In brief, approximately 5,000 genes were selected from the 25,000 genes on the microarray. Okay, so let's get into how they build the model here, right? So they're going to use this data. So they're going to use 78 instead of 98. And they do have 5,000 genes. So the microarrays actually measured 25,000 genes. So they had this data set to start with. And the first thing they did is use sort of basic but still fairly ad hoc procedures to get rid of genes that had very little meaning. So genes that just didn't vary. A gene that had a low expression level for every single one of these. And they removed such genes and ended up with 5,000 after that point. Yes?
So was 5,000 predetermined, or was that...
Let's see how they ended up with 5. They said significantly regulated in more than 3 tumors out of 78. So this is an area which remains completely ad hoc and different in virtually every paper. We call it the initial filtering of meaningless genes. And they decided that, I believe that they did t-tests for significance and required there was some significance in at least 3 out of 78 at some particular significance level, and ended up with 5,000 genes. There's many ways people do this. Some people will say, I'll look at the standard deviation of these gene vectors, and if the standard deviation is less than some cutoff, I'll assume those genes are not varying enough in this data set and get rid of those. Okay. So now they want to build their predictor. Okay, and so we talked about those three steps. And the first step is the choosing a discriminative gene set. So they're going to whittle the 5,000 genes down into a small numbers, which they're going to put in their black box to make their model. And they do this by correlation with ideal outcome. I think we talked about that method before. So first they'll arrange the data set so that all of the good prognosis are up here. Okay, and then P45 through 78 are the poor prognosis. And then they'll make up an ideal vector I and put, let's say, ones here, and then zeros here. And then for each of these 5,000 genes, they'll calculate a correlation coefficient to this ideal vector. So R for gene 1 correlated with ideal vector I was some number, 0.6. And R for gene 2 correlated with vector I is some other number, 0.45, negative 0.45, let's say. And do this for the 5,000 genes. Everyone follow? Okay. So the first thing they do is they get this down to 231 genes by using a cutoff of 0.3, negative or positive. So anything that was between an R between 0.3 and negative 0.3 is gotten rid of here. So they get rid of this one here, this they would keep, this one they would keep, and so forth. And so that left them with 231 genes, which we'll renumber and call these genes now. Yes?
Question relates to the initial point in terms of normalizing their variables and gene expression. Mm-hmm. So as to in the same order as the outcome variable, which is presumably binary, what kind of transformation goes on?
Well, there's two issues here. One is normalizing the data set. So they used cDNA arrays. So their normalization was built in because they used a reference. So a cDNA array is an experiment in which you have two samples applied each time. And their reference consisted of a little bit of RNA from each one of, I think, the larger set. I don't know if it's the 78 or the 98 or 117 mm-hmm. samples. So that was the normalization. Okay. To do this, they just organize it that way. Just move these up here and move these down here.
I guess my question, though, I'm just trying to get to the point as to, do you actually quantify for, in the correlation coefficient, you're looking at direction.
Uh-huh.
But does the amount of expression or difference in expression between the positive and the negative side matter in terms of your correlation?
No.
That
won't matter. Again, you could, Pearson correlation coefficients at least are invariant to linear transformations. So you could take every piece here and multiply by 15 and add 7, and it won't change its correlation coefficient. Okay, so now they were left with 231 genes, right? And all of these genes have some threshold of high correlation, either positive or negative, to this ideal outcome here. So gene 1 had a certain set of expression values in this group, and it was different than in this group because it correlates to, has a high correlation coefficient to that vector. Is that, anyone follow? Okay, so now they do, some people would stop here and say, this is my discriminative native gene set, and the next thing I'm going to do is build my prediction function. And then I'm going to make my rule. And then I'm going to validate. Okay? But they decide to further optimize this discriminative gene set. Okay, so this is a little complex. But what they do, not that complex. So they take the 231 genes that they have here, and they rank order them by largest magnitude of their correlation coefficients. So gene 16 had a correlation coefficient of 0.9, and G12 had a correlation coefficient of negative 0.85. And they rank these going down to G231, which just made it with a correlation coefficient of 0.31 into this group. Okay? So now they're even looking deeper into this data structure, and they're looking for the very best genes that correlate with this outcome. An example of such a gene might be gene 16, which had expression levels that were 1,000 for these samples and was 5 for all of these samples. It was a perfect classifier, that one gene. Okay? So now they're going to really build a discriminated gene set through the following procedure. They're going to take the top 5 from this list. Okay, and call that our discriminative gene set. Discriminative gene set. Consisting of only 5 genes. Okay, then they're going to go through this, build a prediction function, make a rule, and validate using leave one out cross-validation here. All right, then they will add 5 more genes to this discriminative gene set. So they'll go down 5 more in this group and now have a discriminative gene set of 10 genes. They'll take that, build a prediction function, make a rule, and validate again. Now that they've done a second validation, they have a second accuracy number to look at. And they'll say, did my accuracy get better or not? So the first time they did this with the top 5 genes, they found an accuracy in terms of prediction of, I don't know what it was, but we'll make up a number. Let's say 60% predictions were correct after they built their model. So then they did this with another of the larger gene set, including the next 5 best genes, and they found they had a prediction function of 70. That got them up to 70%. And they kept on going until their accuracy was the best it could possibly be and wasn't getting any better with the addition of more genes from the bottom of this list. And there they stopped at 70 genes. So they constructed their discriminative gene set right here as a set of 70 genes based on this optimization of trying first the top 5, building the model, testing the model, and looking at its accuracy, and improving the accuracy until it was as best as it could be. Yes? One would have taken them 5 times as long to get there.
That's true, but 0.31 is more relevant.
Well, that's actually the point that people are trying to make in this field, that one is not relevant, in that the biomarkers that we're now looking for are groups of genes.
I mean in the sense of implemented clinically. I don't mean overall.
This can be implemented clinically. You can, you know, once you set up to make a inkjet synthesized or even robotically spotted array, you can do it for a few dollars. You can spot arrays for a few dollars, basically. This is not actually expensive.
So basically, they're going through finding the minimal amount of these genes that will give them the maximal amount of predictive value for a disease
community. Correct, of predictive accuracy in terms of going for this one prediction of good versus bad outcome.
Now, is there any value in, so they, you know, at each step before they got to the extra revision that you mentioned, you know, sort of close where most people would stop, is there any value in them going outside of their 231 back into the 5,000 and just sort of randomly?
I don't know how far up they went. I don't know if they went past 231. I doubt it. that they then looked at back at other genes.
So I'm saying that the genes, yeah. From there, you know, they narrowed this down to 231 genes. Then they said, okay, well, from there, we've got certain candidates. We're going to pick these five here. Once they've got their 70, is there any value in going back out to the larger data and seeing if they can call a few more things that maybe...
Maybe, but the main critical point of this approach is that this is overfitting. This is very, very serious overfitting of data. I don't think this is what you want to do, but people are still doing it. And I mean, it's fairly reasonable to make this gene set here and stop there. But to do a procedure that you then optimize this set, you stop with the 231, to then take that and to do repetitive cross-validation on the very data that you're using to build the model, and to do it, to select the genes even in that way, is very serious overfitting of a data set. And I put up that fictitious graph yesterday about the points and overfitting it with the best possible curve, but it may not be the right one to make a prediction of a new point here because of how overfitted it is. So it works perfectly for the data set. And I think I brought up some of the pitfalls in terms of validation that's been done with microarray data. I think I passed out a copy of that paper mostly.
Can't that be overcome by, say, cutting the data set in half and doing exactly what you just described, the method that you just described, and then taking that, is what they go, this is part of the process, then taking that other half that they removed, because you did describe,
You can build, right, that's the right way to do it. So that's the training set, and then the validation set. I mean, even, the real right way to do it is to, make up any model you want and then prospectively test it on the next 100 patients.
So the pragmatics is that typically, in 2004, you have so few patients that you're loath to give away too many to your test set because you might not have enough signal in your training set if you could choose more people. Otherwise, and that's the real pragmatics. That's why it's so amazing that Abdal in his real paper could assign a third of his patients to AML and OL. That was only because he had a time to make chips free from that
record. Yeah, when these chips first came out, they were
$2,000 a piece.
$2,000 a piece? Yeah. They're very, I thought they were even more than that. But
even more than that.
So these were very costly experiments to do back then. So this is their discriminative gene set. Okay. Now they have to choose a predictive function. So the predictive function again is if one was to give this model a new clinical specimen, how do we then make a prediction on the new clinical specimen? Okay. And so they used a fairly simple predictive function here, which is correlation coefficient to this ideal outcome. So if I gave you a patient's tissue sample and you did one of these microarray experiments and measured 25,000 different genes on it, then either you would use that in this model by pulling out the numbers from the 70 genes that were part of the discriminative gene set, and then taking that number of 70 genes, and let's see. Sorry, I'm goofing up here. So. Read that. Improved. classifier predicted correctly the outcome. I'm sorry, I thought I understood their predictive function in this paper. Let's take a peek at it. The predictive function is a threshold rule, and that's evident like on figure 2. I believe they took an average number. So they took the average, so bad profile. So they took these profiles here and just average. So there's 34 in this bad group, bad prognosis group. And they took the 34 numbers here and averaged them together to get one number here. And then they did that for their other genes. So we're down to 70 genes right now. And so they have this sort of ideal bad profile. And I'm pretty sure this is what they did. And they did the same thing for the good here. And they have their good profile, which is just an arithmetic mean of the expression levels. And now when the model is presented with a new row vector there of expression data for 70 genes for patients, and we'll call that new patient, patient N, then they will calculate the correlation coefficient of patient N to maybe just the good vector. I guess you can't do it well. So I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the details here a little bit, and I'm having trouble finding them right off here. But I'm pretty sure this is what they did.
I think it's right.
So then which one did they correlate it with?
The good one? Average
profile. Uh-huh. Okay, yeah, which brings up another point. Why not do it to the bad profile and correlate to that as a means of your algorithm? That might give you a very different answer. I'm not quite sure. But in any event, so okay, it seems like there is this choice here that they look at its correlation coefficient to the average good profile and got a number. So this will give you, R will give you a number, 0.4. And that's their prediction function. Okay? And then the last step in this model building is to make up a rule and say, if there's a, and they used a threshold rule in a non-ambiguous classifier, so if it's above the threshold, it's in one group, if it's below the threshold, it's in another group. And they actually explored a different, couple of different possibilities for the threshold. And we talked about that Tuesday, this rule and varying the threshold is the classic trade-off of sensitivity versus specificity here of a test. And they talk about that in this paper and show. So on this diagram here, to try to divide the blacks and the whites to best advantage is the question here, the good versus the bad prognosis. And do we cut it here and get all of the whites with just a couple of blacks, or do we cut a little bit more and get more whites? But we're trading off sensitivity and specificity here. And that's the rule that they use. So that's the model that they use. And then they actually do a couple of, in this paper, they do a couple of things for validation of it for this step right here. And they do pick out a new test, a new validation set of 19 samples that they did not use to build the model here. And it's small. They don't say exactly how they constructed that group of 19. But they do use a separate group of 19 to then test this on. And when they do that, so that's, I guess, page 534, the third paragraph, to validate the prognosis classifier, an additional independent set of primary tumors from 19 young lymph node negative patients were selected. There were 7 patients who had the good outcome, 12 who had the bad, and it resulted in 2 out of 19 incorrect classifications. I think both, so that's how they got an accuracy number out of that, 2 of 19 as the accuracy. One of the important issues that you get into when you do something like that is the accuracy may not be the same for the good versus the bad patients. So you might have a classifier that predicts all of the good outcomes correctly, but is terrible at predicting the bad ones. Half the bad ones it says are good outcomes, and that's not very helpful to you. And so I think the data is in here, and I think it's mentioned in the Pitfall article that I handed out that teases that out a little bit more as to the importance of saying whether the predictor is working equally well on the good and the bad cases that are presented to it. So I think that's essentially this paper. There was a follow-up for this, which was in the New England Journal. It's on the website, which is even more focused on prediction as survival, gene expression signature as a predictor of survival in breast cancer. They used a larger data set here, but they used the same model here. They did validation on the data set, but they didn't do the full validation procedure. So we talked about that, how a lot of validation is done through leave one out. So leave one sample out, build the model, and then test that sample, and then do it for each of the samples 78 times or 200 times, whatever, and see how accurate your predictions are each time. But it's important when you do that to go back and rebuild the choice of the discriminative gene set each time. And this actually is in the New England Journal Medicine, they do actually report both. They're sort of aware of the need to do this. And the numbers, I think, were 24% versus 41% or something, so 27. So when they do the error, when they do the validation based on not doing this step here, rechoosing the gene set, there was a 27% error rate there. But when they did it repeating this gene step, there was a 41% error rate, which is getting close to chance, to flipping a coin. But in any event, so really on the basis of this, the Netherlands Cancer Institute that did this said that they were going to start using this 70 gene set to make clinical decisions. They're going to take new patients with breast cancer, do a microarray experiment, measure the 70 genes, use this model, and make a prediction about good or bad outcome, and tailor their treatment according to that. Yes?
So, Mike, I actually have a question related to this, and it's more on the actual side. So, a lab puts out a study like this, says here are 70 genes that we think are a good, you know, indicator of metastasis or disease progression. Other labs are going to want to validate these results.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, in gathering, so in collecting this data, like for this particular study, they're looking at patients over 5 years. Mm-hmm. You do a microarray analysis on a patient, and they pop up positive or whatever for this indicator. Now you've got people making clinical decisions on this, and it seems like the validation method is in, like, in the withheld data. they need to have, like, you know, a bad prognosis, a bad, or a bad outcome, right? The people, in order to, like, say that these candidates are, you know, for the patient, that is, that these 70 genes actually do have a negative effect, or indicate that there's a negative effect, that effect has to be there. So how does a clinician, or, you know, a clinical researcher, for that matter, who kind of sees patients and does it, how do they balance that? I mean, what would your suggestion or advice be to, you know, like, does that make any sense at all?
Well, you're talking about how do you do research on patients in this area?
Or how do you make... feel using this clinically?
Well, not how confident you feel using it clinically. So we have this result. People need to validate it.
Yep.
In the process of validating, they're going to find people who have this particular pattern, right? And they need to follow those people over a certain time course. And in order to validate their own essentially, if none of the people who have these 70 genes or expression profiles or whatever develop breast cancer, then the model's kind of having to go back to the drawing board. So essentially, and I hate to say it this way, but I can't think of it.
No, say it how what you're thinking.
They need these people in order to validate the model. They need them to progress to disease state. Yet at the same time, they're sort of as clinicians, as what, you know. So putting aside the researcher part, as clinicians, they need to treat these patients. And if there's a strong indication from prior studies that you know, good chance you're going to get breast cancer and it's going to metastasize and it's going to be really bad for you, they can't just like not treat these people aggressively. But that treatment is going to affect that outcome over the.
Well, people, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So no, I don't think anybody's doing. Yes. So nobody's denying treatment or withholding best known treatments to patients.
So how do you factor that into the validation of your modeling? Knowing that if you get, I mean, you can't, because you can't say, well, they didn't have metastasis, but it was because of my treatment.
There are a few issues, and you actually, so in this New England Journal of Medicine paper, I did not pass that one out. It's on the website. What they did is they used this model on a larger group of patients, and they then compared predictions of this model to best clinical predictors. So, for example, there's other predictive scales, and they used one called the St. Galen scale, which predicts outcome in breast cancer. And they said, you know, how does our model compare to the St. Galen scale? We take all of these patients and we see what their St. Galen's number was and how they did, and we take our predictions and how they did, which is better. And they concluded that their method was better than the St. Galen's method of making predictions. And that was really one of the principal justification for saying we have a better method to make predictions about how patients are going to do, and we're going to start using this in the Netherlands at the Cancer Institute to make our decisions rather than St. Galen's. Okay? And what you point out is actually a big flaw in research that does this, because patients had their St. Galen's scale determined when they were diagnosed, and depending on what their clinicians thought, treated them accordingly in order to achieve best outcome. So if they were in a poor outcome group to begin with, based on St. Galen's criteria, they got treated more aggressively to try and make their outcome better. So actually the goal of the clinician is to, for the St. Galen scale not to be right on these group of patients, right? The interventions that took place on these patients, because it was not a prospective controlled study, the interventions that took place were specifically designed to mitigate the poor prognosis that the St. Galen's criteria indicated on these patients. And so it may not be a surprise that the St. Galen's predictor was not all that accurate later on, because people were intervening actively with that results of that predictor to change outcome. And that wasn't happening with gene expression profiles. Nobody looked at the gene expression profile of these patients 10 years ago and then decided how they were going to treat them over the next 5 years. to make their disease better.
So is it just that because for right now, the turnaround on the analysis of gene expression profiles is long enough that the Galen's approach or a regressive treatment or whatever, that turnaround is long enough that you'll have your answer and your validation before clinical decisions start getting made, and repeat experiments are done to sort of cross-validate,
There'll never be to get a new drug approved in this country for labeling requires that you take a group of patients with a disease and you treat some of them with the drug and some of them with a placebo and you see which works. To ever really know whether prediction models are going to work accurately, one needs to do the same thing, to take patients prospectively, to apply prediction models to them ahead of time, and to see what happens with them without an intervention that's based on the result of the prediction. That's why I find a paper like this perspective here kind of scary, the microarrays in clinical investigations from today's journal, where the authors envision that in the future clinical investigations will consist of small trials with a high density of data, precise patient stratification according to expression profile, and highly tailored analysis of microarray data, otherwise known as massive overfitting of tons of expression data in a small number of patients here. And that's never going to tell you whether your predictions are correct. And if you're going to make decisions about treatment or predictions based on that, you won't be accurate. I don't believe that there'll be sufficient accuracy from small. So I don't think that trials need to get smaller, and that trials can be made smaller because we now have microarray data. In fact, trials need to be probably larger because you have that much more undetermined data set. Right. Well, so the Netherlands Cancer Institute, they patented their set of genes as a predictor of breast cancer. So hoping that they'll have the patent, and if they show that their stuff works, then people will come to them and they'll start wholesaling their type of arrays and their approach. So do you know that I haven't seen anything, Zach. I mean, there was an article that they were going to start doing this in the summer of 2003. It was in Nature, we're going to start doing this, and
I think
silence. Did they come to their senses?
That's what I'm thinking must happen. I think that probably somebody who actually knew this is saying, do you really want to screw our patients over by doing this?
Uh-huh.
But I don't know that for a fact.
Right.
It's actually, go ahead.
There was an article a couple weeks ago in Nature, about
the
RGB
kind of market,
though.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember how
they're
marketing them, so they don't need
FDA approval. Well, there's two issues.
There's two
issues here. One is whether FDA approves these gene chips in general. We'll get back to that in a second. But narrowly, whether we can use with all the quality that's described, these kind of predictive algorithms on any platform. And I think as a responsible clinician, most of us would not right now necessarily stratify our patients based on this analysis alone. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Even though it's been done for cancer?
It's been done kind of for cancer in some oncology trials, and it's kind of scary to me that it's been done. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it should have done, but it's been done. The way cancer is done in this country is within big academic centers, in cooperative oncology groups, where large numbers of individuals are treated in protocols, and those are now being stratified by expression profiles for some studies. I can't say that I fully agree with that. With regard to actually using the measurement technology, Roche Diagnostics made the headlines about 2 months ago, where they tried to get a chip, not for expression, but for genotyping, mutations in the P450 genes that clear a variety of toxic chemicals out of our body in the liver. They tried, and therefore it's very important for pharmacogenomics, because it'll tell you how fast the growth appeared. Roche tried to get it through a waiver that essentially said this is just a method of measurement, we don't really have to get a specific FDA approval. The FDA said no, hold it, we have to go through the formal approval process. So what Cecily is talking about is that it's been announced that another batch of children will see if they get repeated the same way. And this is it's actually an active battle. As some of you are involved in HSP, you should know that HSP is actually very much involved in trying to help the FDA figure out exactly how to look at this, because believe it or not, the FDA has only now developed the minimum standards of data submission from pharmaceutical companies on the microarray data. They have no guidelines whatsoever on the standardized interpretation of such platforms. So I think there's going to be several hops, skips, and jumps to get these kind of measurements translated from research descriptions to clinical measures. They still can be used, by the way, just to give you, they still can be used in a medical center without FDA approval, as long as they're not sold. So for instance, the Harvard Center for Genetics and Genomics has contracted with Affymetrix for a resequencing chip for known genes involved in hearing loss and in cardiomyopathies. But Partners is not selling this for general use. It's being used internally by its clinicians. And so it's a very tricky process that is where regulation hits genomics. In fact, we'll be doing a lecture about that later on.
Is Margulies giving that lecture?
Yes.
Okay, that's all for today.